I'd like to welcome Janet Heimlich. She's an award-winning journalist. She's a former NPR reporter. She's the author of Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. And she's the founder of the Child-Friendly Faith Project. Welcome.
Thanks so much.
And we're joined by Dr. Jaime Romo, who is president of the Child-Friendly Faith Project. He's a minister in the United Church of Christ for Healing and Healthy Environments in San Diego. He's author of several books. He works with people who have PTSD and trauma. He's a hospice chaplain and much more. Welcome.
Thanks.
So we're talking about religious child maltreatment, and there is child abuse of all kinds, unfortunately, throughout our society. What do we mean about child abuse, child maltreatment in a religious context? What are some examples?
Sure. I think first it's important to just get a definition of that. So we call it religious child maltreatment, maltreatment being both abuse and neglect. And it's defined as child abuse or neglect that is enabled by religious beliefs held by perpetrators, victims, or the surrounding community. Examples of that would include medical neglect, for example, based on an adult's belief about faith healing and the idea that if you pray hard enough that a child's diabetes or infection or something like that would be cured. Now, we look at one state in particular, Idaho, which loses more children a year, more children die in Idaho due to religious medical neglect than any other state, simply because there is a particular church there called the Followers of Christ that refuse to give children medical care based on their beliefs about faith healing, and the law allows them to do that without repercussion. So, for example, there was one case of a 15-year-old girl. She got food poisoning. Now, most of us, if our child got food poisoning, after a while, if they just continue vomiting and it's not letting up, we would clearly be concerned about dehydration. We would probably take them to hospital or urgent care clinic so they can get hydrated and so forth. These folks did nothing but pray for her. And so this girl, after days of vomiting, getting dehydrated, ended up dying from a ruptured esophagus. That kind of thing would just never happen in a community that didn't have those kinds of extremist beliefs. And again, something very curable. So we see a lot of cases of that. When it comes to physical abuse, if kids are beaten or we can say spanked because the parents believe that, say, a passage in Proverbs talking about, quote, the rod tells them, or maybe their pastor is telling them, that they have to use physical punishment whenever a child does something that they consider to be wrong. So a lot of conservative religious folks will try to control their children using physical punishment and authoritarian parenting techniques, which have been shown to be very, very unhealthy and harmful. So we've seen cases where kids have died because they went into shock because their parents believe so strongly in this idea of justifying physical punishment with religion, they just let the beatings go on and on and on. They weren't beating out of anger necessarily. It was more done in a methodical way because they felt that they were being righteous in how they were disciplining their children.
These were beatings. The case I think you're talking about, or one of them, was where parents literally beat a kid all day long, took lunch breaks,
prayer breaks.
Yeah.
Yeah. They all also, if the case, I mean, there have been a number of these, but I know the one you're talking about, they also had some of the siblings be accomplices. And that's something else that you'll see in an entire household or a community where they will have children partake in some of this stuff. And that is incredibly psychologically harmful for those siblings, especially later in life, if they've taken a part in this and then felt all kinds of stress, trauma, and anxiety as a result.
And what comes to mind for me is an authoritarian group that indoctrinates, that sets up a religious rationale for the way they treat, is part of a continuum that can lead to, I'm thinking of a couple of folks I've worked with PTSD that stemmed from ritual abuse, where as children they were a part of a community that were taken out and exposed to all kinds of very terrifying events, people being put into coffins, not being sure if they were, had been killed or if they were dead. Sometimes, as Janet mentioned, given an active role of carrying something or being a part of filing by this body.
This body being a child?
Yes, yes. And so there's a continuum of what happens that is incomprehensible or that may also be very, very hurtful in a religious setting that can lead to physical abuse, neglect, as well as sexual abuse, as well as, you know, terrifying experiences like that.
I want to be clear that we're not saying that any kind of a religious upbringing mm-hmm. is unhealthy or mm-hmm. harmful. I think if I had to kind of boil our message down, it would be to say, think about what your religious practice, how it's affecting your child. A lot of times people just make an assumption that if it's part of religious faith, it's got to be beneficial. Well, maybe that is for most of the adults, but that doesn't always translate to children. So we really are pressing parents especially to just give thought, taking a minute to look at whether the religious practice that you are bringing your child into is actually good for their well-being.
Well, I mean, it's hard to understand how anybody could think that beating a child all day long could be good for the children's well-being. And it speaks to the level of indoctrination on the parents whose natural instinct is to protect their children. What are they thinking? I mean, I know that there are some cases of exorcisms or people who feel like they're physically beating the devil out of their children. I mean, what's going on?
Well, there are many different factors. I mean, any case of child abuse is usually pretty complicated. It can be the result of, if that's the case of the parent as perpetrator, them having been raised since birth in the same religious culture. But there are also many other psychological factors that can play into it. The parent could have problems with anger management. In the case of beating children because, you know, they feel it's best for the child, that's often justified because of religious messaging that says that if you beat a child, they have a better chance of going to heaven and not going to hell. So really, there are many different things that can play into it. I personally, especially since I'm not a psychologist, don't spend much time trying to get into the heads of the perpetrators. I look more at the systemic problems that I see happening in religious households and communities that could lead to these problems.
And I think that there is a connection between, and there's research that you've pointed to, Janet, those who follow the externals of religion as a way to guide their life, rather than the internals of it, that lead to a kind of a disconnect between the belief and the actual experience.
Talk about that more. What do you mean by the internals and the externals?
There are people that are religiously intrinsic, people that are interested in a faith community because of just what they feel they get out of it spiritually. Then you have extrinsic faith, where people are actually getting something outside of the faith, for example, popularity or power or something like that. We found a study that actually looked at people who believe intrinsically versus extrinsically. And the study found that people who are more of an extrinsic belief system are more likely to abuse children.
So people who join the church because they think that it will bring them some external benefit?
Yeah.
Well, the external benefit could be belonging. I mean, it could be fulfilling that sense of I am worth something and I can be in this group. And it may be a sense of the role that they can take up and kind of that power that may come, or the authority that may come with that. It's not necessarily a monetary or material.
There seems to be some kind of a correlation between authoritarian religions and child mistreatment. Is that correct? Like, explain that.
Yeah, religious authoritarian cultures. And I use that term because, again, I want to kind of get away from this idea that if it's this brand of religion, then it's got to be harmful or it's got to be beneficial. It really doesn't matter what the religious belief system is in terms of, is it Catholic, or is it Jewish, or is it Islamic, or something else. It more has to do with how people interact with each other in a particular environment, or in a particular religious environment. So you could have a Jewish community, for example, where there is very little or next to no authoritarian influences going on. And so I'm not saying that there would not be any abuse or neglect, but it's very unlikely that it would be enabled by religious belief. Whereas you could have a Jewish community that's very authoritarian. And you have parents then that are what we call middle manager parents, and they're not using their instincts so much as going along more with the rules of child rearing. So that's kind of how those negative influences end up ultimately affecting the well-being of children.
When we talk about childhood sexual abuse in a religious context, the first thing that comes to mind is all those priests that have gone, and many probably still are, with impunity, abusing children. And as we know from the film Spotlight, sometimes it comes out years later, the effects of the abuse on the victims can last a lifetime. Is that the main thing that's going on? Or?
I'm not sure if I can speak to the main thing going on, but it's certainly, I think, a very clear kind of disconnect between the faith and the good works and the actual individual practices that are supported by the hierarchy that has moved priests from place to place, and the kind of the code of silence that is often shared among the clergy themselves and bishops themselves, who have passed on people from parish to parish or diocese to diocese. They have been moved along. And so while Spotlight has raised that attention to that specific case, it's certainly ongoing, even though there have been policies put into place and even trainings that I have led in some cases in some Catholic settings. But that's probably the most organized and kind of coherent as a group. But certainly that child sexual abuse is prevalent across traditions.
I'll say, looking at the Catholic Church, there are certain religious beliefs and even scriptural passages that I believe have been very harmful to making children vulnerable and exposed to danger when it comes to child sexual abuse. For example, there was a mention in canon law that came out sort of a few decades ago, and it talked about child sexual abuse, and it was warning clergy to not engage in this with minors. It didn't say against minors, but with minors. And it kind of set up the minor as being more of an accomplice than as a victim. Another example would be just the belief that clergy have some kind of godliness about them. So if you have that kind of religious belief, then a parent is probably much less likely to be vigilant when their child has been selected to go spend time one-on-one with a priest.
Well, not only that, but a lot of the time when the kid comes and says, the priest abused me, which it takes a lot of courage for a kid to say, the parents punish the kid.
Absolutely. And that we have seen across the board. I've heard that from people in Jewish communities as well as Islamic communities.
That interpersonal dynamic is very, very powerful. When I, as an adult, recalled this experience, and it at that time it was just a flash of a memory, and I mentioned that to my mother. She was the best friend of this pastor, and for many years had maintained that relationship, and she continued to maintain that relationship with him. She couldn't speak to him directly, and that was basically the end of our relationship. So there's a very powerful pull between, oh my God, how can I accept that this person who I value, the minister person who represents God, who represents all these things that I've been a part of, could actually do that. And so parents can often disbelieve. And on top of that, in that community, there have been policies to send information to Rome where it's protected, to send individuals to Rome where they are protected from civil law.
If you don't mind, could you tell us your own story and your path to doing this work, Dr. Jaime Romo?
Sure. I grew up as a cradle Catholic in Northeast LA. So we were poor, hungry.
Cradle Catholic?
Yeah. So my grandparents were Catholic, my mom, dad were Catholic. It was in our bones, right? I grew up with my grandmother living in the front house. She was blind and she would sit in her rocker praying the rosary all the time. And so I was very much rooted in not just cultural, but also a religious tradition that were really blended, you know. So whenever we left the house, we would come to her and she would give us a blessing. So she was the in-home kind of God representative. And that blind faith to authority was given to elders, right? So my grandmother was blind. She tried to feed me sometimes, you know. I don't know how she made her way through the kitchen, but I remember one time her giving me a bowl of Trix cereal and asked, you know, you got to eat breakfast. And it had bugs in it, but she didn't see that. But I had, at that point, no ability to tell her. You know, I had that, like, she's the elder. I can't confront. I can't challenge. I can't question. And I ate it. I was hungry. And so, you know, carry that forward to being in the parish where school was the safe place, went to a Catholic school, where I was an altar boy, where we were adopted basically and given special attention by the priest, which is a huge honor, going forward into a Catholic high school. The abuse happened in early high school over a period of a few years. And there was the whole grooming process where here is this revered figure, not just in the parish, but in the diocese. So this person was very prominent, you know, the prince of the diocese, who offered me a job in the rectory. And that was helpful to my family. And my mom was central to the parish, and so she completely trusted him. And I could eat there. They had food. We didn't have much. And so there was a kind of a dependency. There was a kind of, like, specialness. He took me on trips. He gave me gifts. We went to Palm Springs. At one point, he took me to Hawaii. Like, I was his son. And so little by little, that affection and trust continued where he could be more affectionate and in public give me a kiss or embrace me. And then when he changed parishes, and some things happened in that setting as well, where I was exposed to him and another diocesan worker to very sexual conversations, joking. And at one point, his friend, so I was working in the rectory and upstairs between the services, I would be upstairs doing my homework or eating or watching a game. And he and his friend would often stop by. And in one of these occasions, besides the joking, very suggestive discussions about their relationship, actually, his friend dropped his pants and showed off his fishnet underwear. And the Monsignor laughed and said, oh, you know, Louis, what a crazy guy. And he's so funny. And it was all this process of normalizing sexual and inappropriate and incomprehensible experiences.
And meanwhile, you were a young teenager?
Yeah, I was 13. And so that progressed then to when he moved to his other parish, and then I became basically the person who would stay overnight because he didn't want to be alone because the other priest had gone away for the weekend. And so that progressed to more physical. Well, there was always alcohol, I would say that, in the rectory, as well as when we would go out to dinner. He would buy two drinks, strong alcohol, and the waitresses and others would give him a pass. You know, who would question this person? So there are things like that, that not just kind of emotionally, but also like cognitively made me very vulnerable. And so the sexual abuse progressed, staying overnight at his place until I was about 17, able to drive and physically bigger and more involved in school. And I think that coincided. And all this was I was very disconnected. I mean, I dissociated in many of those experiences. And so I really had a different life, a life that I participated with him in his special meals and special trips and so on, and abuse. And then the life where I was the star student and captain of the soccer team. And, you know, I went to prep high school and then I went to Stanford. So I didn't realize how I channeled all that rage into something that helped me to feel like I was actually okay. I was very disconnected from all of that.
Did you ever say no? I mean, did you find a way to end it, or do you, like, graduate out, or?
No. The response that I experienced was often freezing and physically dissociating. I remember, not at the time, but remember years later, feeling myself out of my own body and you know, watching. So at the time, it was all, You know, there's those normal fight flight responses, and others are freezing or fainting. And I think that's what happened for me.
I mean, there's so many things I want to ask you. I mean, one of them is, when you think about how long and premeditated a grooming mm-hmm. process is mm-hmm. on the part of the abuser, mm-hmm. it's really shocking. And it feels like they're just the most horrifying kinds of criminals.
Mm-hmm. Sure. And while that's a pattern for all kinds of sexual predators, this is on the platform of having gained the trust and the adulation and the blind faith in this individual, so people can not see what is there in front of them, the red flags that are there.
You said a moment ago that when you were starting a process of remembering and starting to heal, you talked to your mother and she wouldn't acknowledge it, and that put a break between you. And I think a lot of people who are healing from religious abuse have to actually make that break and leave the community, which is, it's so double-edged. It seems like it's really hard, even though you have to do it.
Well, that's the case in the family, and it's even expanded in a religious setting. So in a family setting, which where most abuse happens, sexual abuse happens, and people who are familiar, so clergy are in that second tier of trusted and familiar people. When one person confronts the individual, it's not just the individual, it's confronting the whole family system. And similarly, this is confronting a whole community of faith, call it. Plus, there's all the shame. The person who's bringing this experience, as well as the shame of others who perhaps have known or colluded in some way or been in denial. So it is a loss of identity with this whole group.
What does it take to heal? How do you and your network work with people who have had childhood sexual abuse, who are now adults, or maybe who are still young people?
One of the things that is so important is just to be in a public voice, a witness, someone who creates a space that others can acknowledge their own experiences. And I think that's what individuals have done through various religious traditions at great cost, individual and as well as kind of institutional repercussions. And then in taking up a role as a minister for healing and healthy environments, that was a way for me to integrate my own experience, regain a connection of deep kind of spiritual life, and rebuild in a way that I could bring all of that experience, the recognition of what had happened for me that allowed others to acknowledge their own experience, and then formally actually bring training, formally bring a process for individuals and for groups.
And I think that that model can be helpful to someone who has suffered any kind of religious abuse. Very often we will hear about child sexual abuse, particularly from religious organizations that want to speak to it. They want to say that they abhor it. They will have trainers come in and talk about it. I just want to be clear that a big reason why religious organizations will kind of focus on that is because that's the type of maltreatment that they're most likely to be sued for. It's really important that we, while we definitely try to serve survivors of child sexual abuse, that we also give resources to survivors of physical abuse, medical neglect, and I think emotional abuse and neglect is going to be in every one of these cases. I can't imagine that you would have a case of sexual abuse where there wasn't. I mean, Jaime's story really reminded me of so many other survivors who it was the trauma they had to deal with of the abuse, but then not having any of that acknowledged by the people that they thought were there to protect them is a whole nother, that's emotional maltreatment. So we're here in our organization, the Child Friendly Faith Project, is about raising awareness of all forms of religious child maltreatment. And that includes forms of abuse and neglect that are legal.
Like what?
Well, for example, in conservative Jewish organizations, after they circumcise a male infant, which in and of itself is traumatic, abusive to a child, just as it would be for females, then it's common practice for the moel, the rabbi, to suck the wound. Now, in most contexts, that would be seen as sexual abuse.
They're literally sucking the infant's penis
after the circumcision. This practice goes back hundreds of years. There are religious communities that refuse to stop doing that, even though, because such a large percentage of our population has herpes 1, some of these moels have transferred their disease to the infant. And an infant's body has very little ability to fight herpes 1. So there have been infants who have gotten brain damage, who have died because of it, and yet that is a practice that is legal in every state. I talked about circumcision in and of itself, certainly legal. It's very controversial. Other countries don't circumcise infants nearly as much as the United States and Israel. We believe that if it's not for medical reasons, you should not be doing any kind of genital cutting on children of any sex or age. And then we talked about physical punishment or spanking. As long as you do not physically injure a child, it is legal to do that. Based on what we know about child development and healthy parenting techniques, there's never been a study that has shown that physical punishment is actually healthy for the well-being of a child. And so we oppose using that method to discipline children. So we can talk about some of the extreme cases of religious abuse and neglect, but I think it's also important to understand the ones that are very pervasive in American culture, even though they're not in, say, European cultures.
There's a huge study called the ACEs study, Adverse Childhood Experiences. The basic gist of this is that when a person has a handful of these adverse childhood experiences, whatever they would be, and all of these things, neglect, witnessing, you know, physical, emotional, sexual abuse, being a part of that itself, and so on, those are correlated with all kinds of often self-destructive or other destructive behaviors, physically as well as emotionally. And so just linking to what Janet was talking about, while we can talk about sexual abuse, the factors that set up someone for that are present in other settings. The ways that people assent to certain experiences or practices that are harmful and don't question those are the background for more extreme types of child maltreatment.
What do you mean? Like, give us an example.
So Janet was just talking about, well, we have legal practices that are harmful, that are traumatic. Those things allow then for people to not question other practices, whether they're formal, individual practices.
So like maybe a kid who was beaten a lot, then wouldn't question a fraternity hazing, that kind of thing?
I'd say that's a secular version of that, yeah.
Yeah.
And I may not have made clear that there have been many, many, many studies that have shown that physical punishment is very harmful to children, both physically, emotionally, leads to sexual problems, and often does not bring about the kind of compliance that the parents believe that it does.
And I guess I want to acknowledge how taboo it is, how shocking it may be, or how difficult it may be for some people to hear, you know, questioning circumcision or any kind of genital mutilation or corporal punishment, because that is so much a part of our culture as a larger body.
And they may have gone through it themselves, mm-hmm. and said, I came out okay.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You were both talking about types of what you and many consider child abuse that are legal. There's also many kinds of child abuse, religious and otherwise, that are not legal, that are felonies, essentially. What are some of the problems involved in getting those reported when they're in a religious context and getting them prosecuted and getting the children brought to safety?
I think a lot of it has to do with how separatist the religious organization is. If you have a religious community that is more on the liberal side, that is not authoritarian, it would be just a natural thing for people to report child abuse or neglect, whether it's motivated by religion or not. But if you have an organization or community that is more separatist, more authoritarian, strict hierarchy about things, and what also goes into that is being a fear-based membership, then there's going to be a much stronger tendency to keep it within the religious community. And some religions have very complex systems to, quote, prosecute those kinds of crimes within the community. The Beth Din of Jewish communities would be an example, and the Catholic Church, of course, with canon law and so forth. So they will believe that they're taking care of it by perhaps doing some kind of, you know, religious sanctioning of a perpetrator or something like that. But almost always they will refuse to report to outside authorities. So law enforcement doesn't hear about it. Child Protective Services doesn't hear about it. Even in cases where the child dies, back to Idaho or places that allow parents to deny medical care to their kids for religious reasons. In those places, CPS won't even investigate a case.
CPS.
Child Protective Services or law enforcement will not even investigate a case, because if it was in a faith-healing extremist church, then it's actually legal to do that, and it's not considered to be medical neglect. So it's very difficult for the public to even learn about those cases unless there's a death and unless, you know, a reporter decides really to look into it.
It's a very strange thing, because we do live in a country where we have a constitutional separation between church and state. We don't have any state-sanctioned religions, and yet we have these religious exemptions that basically, what, legalize abuse and murder? I mean, is that the reality?
When I look at a case, or I even define what is abuse or neglect, statutes will make those definitions very clear, but then there will be these exceptions. Or if they're not codified, you know, people just look the other way and allow certain things to take place. In our view, we don't make any exceptions to accommodate for religions, even if it's in statute. So if something's considered abuse, for example, hitting a child, then we're going to consider it abuse regardless of whether it's permitted because it's, quote, discipline, or permitted because someone thought they were following a passage in the Bible.
And the thought I have may seem a bit far-reaching, but the discovery doctrine came out of the Catholic theology, right? That the country was inhabited by people who were not, they didn't have a soul necessarily. They weren't the same level of Christian. And so the land was available for people to come in and take. And subsequently for the colonists here to claim the land from the Native Americans and from indigenous peoples throughout South America. So there's this theology that has influenced law, which has then had a huge impact.
What I'm asking about is the relationship between the law, law enforcement, on the one hand, and these exemptions on the other. It seems like a real legal disconnect. I mean, people are committing felonies, misdemeanors, crimes, whatever, and getting away with it because their religion says they can do it, even though the law of the land that they live in says it's a crime. Is that what we're looking at?
No, if something is considered a crime, then that person will be prosecuted.
But not in Idaho.
Right, because it is not a crime there.
So beating your kid to death is not a crime in Idaho?
It certainly is a crime. What is not a crime is allowing your child to suffer, get very sick, or die from medical neglect if it's religiously inspired. There is a big disconnect between people who, I want to say, kind of get it and understand where religious practices stop and children's rights begin, and people that are just so fervent with their religious belief, they just feel the government should stay out of our lives to the point of not even protecting children. But then you have a whole lot of people in between that I think are kind of finding these kinds of issues rather muddy. And really, I think what it comes down to is the legislators who pass the laws, what their religious beliefs are. So back to Idaho, you have legislators that personally believe in faith healing so much that they believe they are being righteous by not prosecuting those parents. One legislator, in fact, even he was quoted in a public hearing basically saying, we're kind of doing the children a favor by allowing them to die from this kind of medical neglect, because then they're there, then they've gone up to heaven, and that's where we're all trying to be. So we'll find them later. So in his view, he's got this whole religious narrative that justifies these children going through the most horrible suffering you can imagine, similar to what probably took place in the Middle Ages.
You are both involved with the Child Friendly Faith Project. What is this project doing, and what kind of progress have you made since you, Janet, wrote the book Breaking Their Will?
Well, our main mission is to educate and raise awareness of religious child maltreatment. Currently, we're working on developing a whole set of new resources that will be on our website, and they're available to several kind of key groups that really do want to learn about this topic. One would be survivors who are looking for resources to help them find healing. Secondly, people of faith who are really disturbed by how religion is being used in such a way to harm children. And then the general public that are just shocked about some of these high-profile cases and want to learn more about it.
And I think we're in the reinforcing stage of figuring out with board members how to actually move forward on some of these more difficult issues. I mean, I think no one is really be opposed to greater awareness, but to take on issues of corporal punishment or just acknowledge those as part of the larger picture of child well-being and child-friendly faith is difficult.
We have a curriculum. It's the only one that we know of that can be used by religious organizations to learn about religious child maltreatment. It's a discussion series that they do kind of on their own behind closed doors, and we offer support with a liaison to work with them. But we've had a couple of religious organizations that have done it. One was a church, one was a synagogue. And they felt it was really helpful to understand some of these concepts and move forward, whether it's with their Sunday school classes or their sermons to parents and that kind of thing, in a more educated way.
Are there any legislative ways to address religious child maltreatment?
Well, Janet was a part of an effort in Idaho not too long ago, and I think what we would look forward to going forward is to partner with groups that are dealing, I think, specifically with legislative issues, whether they be statute of limitations or this religious exemption.
There's a new one called Child USA, which is going to be looking at academic studies that they can get started, as well as legislative change. That's run by a woman named Marcy Hamilton, who is a renowned constitutional scholar and knows a whole lot about legislation. She wrote a book called God Versus the Gavel, and she's written other books too that look at how religiously influenced legislation can leave a lot of people unprotected. So that's one organization we want to partner with. We ourselves are not going to get too involved with legislation. We just don't have the resources for that, but we definitely want to help raise awareness to the legislative issues that we all need to be looking at.
I have to say, there's a huge irony here that I just have to put words to it, which is, if you think people have the right to life before they're born, but not after?
It is a big irony. It really is, because in a lot of these places where they have these religious exemptions and so forth, letting kids die from medical neglect and so forth, they're usually very conservative communities. So they're very, very anti-abortion. And I do think that religion plays a role in this, having to do with baptism and that kind of thing. But it does seem like they are way more interested in protecting children before they're born than after they're born.
I would say, I mean, to borrow the general jargon, and instead of just being pro-birth, we want to be pro-life, right? And so I think as an organization, we want to be a voice that acknowledges that, and that will invite others from whatever faith tradition to do that work as well.
When you, Dr. Jaime, work with people, what are some of the difficulties in healing from this particular kind of abuse? And what does it take to really heal and have a healthy life and not pass it on to your kids?
Well, that's a beautiful question. And what I love in working with trauma, specifically with those who come from trauma from religious experiences, whether they be in a particular group where they've been disfellowed, or and the experiences led to that, or ritual abuse, or any other kinds of things where they've internalized this deep message that somehow, you know, God was behind it. And so the healing process is to really create a space where people can recognize, can reprocess that. And what I do is a process called traumatic incident reduction. So it's not a traditional talk therapy, but it is very trauma specific. But it helps people, though, to come away with a new insight as well as to reintegrate their experience. We had a Dia de los Muertos ceremony, and one of the people who came was someone who I did sessions with. And she said that at this point she was now able to see the things that she gained from that person, as well as and acknowledge without the shame, the abuse.
The things she gained from her perpetrator?
Yes. And so that's, to me, the healing is that the end result is people are able to integrate all those different experiences. But it really comes through being able to have a space where people can be heard, where people can bring that, and that alone is difficult. And then by having spaces in a community, in a congregation. I've done several presentations of facilitated groups and done workshops where just opening up that space allows people to acknowledge publicly for the first time, and especially in a church setting, which is very healing. So to be able to integrate the healing part or the value of their faith, whatever that was, with the experiences they brought is a start.
Before we go, if anybody's listening who thinks maybe their church or the church of somebody they know is involved in activities that are harmful to children or maybe families, there's some suspicion there, what should they look for? What should they do?
In my book, Breaking Their Will, I have a list of questions for parents or any member of a religious organization that they can ask themselves to help determine whether they're in an authoritarian culture that's harmful to kids. And some of those questions have to do with the belief system and exclusivity. For example, does my religious community believe that we have the only religious truth and everyone else is misguided? As a parent, does my religious leader tell me how to raise my children? Does he or she tell me I should physically discipline my child? If I am aware of abuse perhaps going on, do I feel free to just go to authorities and report suspected abuse? Or is it pretty much frowned upon that I should just tell my religious leader instead? So questions like that can be helpful to really determine whether or not it's a healthy environment for kids and for families.
Janet Heimlich is founder of the Child Friendly Faith Project. She's a journalist. She's author of the book Breaking Their Will, Shedding Light on Religious Child Maltreatment. Dr. Jaime Romo is president of the Child Friendly Faith Project, and he is a minister. He works with people who have PTSD, and he's the author of several books as well. Thank you both so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.